everybody, and welcome back to New Books in History. I'm Marshall Poe, your host. Each week we pick a history book that we find particularly interesting, and we interview the author of that book. This week we're happy to have Godfrey Hodgson on the show, and we'll be talking about his new book, The Myth of American Exceptionalism. You may think that America is different from all other countries. Many Americans think this. Mr. Hodgson does not, and he puts forward a very impressive and challenging case in this book. I agreed with some of it, and I didn't agree with other parts of it, but I can tell you that I certainly found the conversation very stimulating, and I think that you'll find the interview stimulating as well, because Mr. Hodgson has seen a lot and done a lot and met everyone and written for everyone and is a really an old hand and a seasoned observer of American life. So he's somebody we should definitely listen to. And I was glad that I got the chance to talk to him. I hope that you enjoy the interview. Here it is. Hi, Godfrey.
Hi, Marshall. How are you?
I'm very well today. Where are you exactly? You're in the UK, obviously, but...
Yes, I'm sitting in my home, which is about 12 miles outside of Oxford in a village.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I work. I'm in my study, surrounded by books and stuff like that.
Well, that sounds really wonderful. I of course, am in Iowa, surrounded by corn. No, that's really not
right.
True.
Well, I'm staying at a field of wheat right in front of me.
I should tell our listeners that we are very pleased and honored to have Godfrey Hodgson on the show today, and we'll be talking about his really provocative new book, The Myth of American Exceptionalism, for the following hour. And I have to tell you, I read the book and found it very thought-provoking as an American. I think we can make Godfrey an honorary American. He spent so much time here. Godfrey, why don't you begin by telling us a little bit about your career, which has been intertwined with America for a long time.
Yeah, that's right. I studied at Oxford, and after that I went to the University of Pennsylvania, where I did a master's in history. I went back to England, where I went into journalism. I worked on the London Times for a while, then on the Observer, and very quickly I was sent back to the United States as the Observer's Washington correspondent. One interesting thing had happened to me already. When I was a graduate student at Penn, I and another graduate student went to stay with an African-American friend who had been at Oxford as a Fulbright. And while he lived in Montgomery, and while we were there, I met Martin Luther King.
Did you really? Wow.
And that is coming sort of full circle, because I'm just about to publish a biography of King.
Really? That's fantastic.
But King, people were not really, never mind in England, people in the United States were not that really up on the civil rights movement. The smartest thing I ever did, actually, when I was a young correspondent, I went to Mr. Russell Wiggins, the then editor of the Washington Post, Ben Bradley's predecessor, mm-hmm. and I said, can I have a desk in your newsroom? And he said, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I promised not to be a nuisance. but the thing was that I was interested in King because I'd met him before. I had some access to him. And really nobody at the Post at that time was really very much abreast of the civil rights movement. The reporter who covered the civil rights movement was called Robert E. Lee Decker. And Bob was not really tremendously sort of plugged into African-American life.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a fascinating story. Actually, I've said this many times on this show, but my only similar claim to fame is to have played basketball quite a bit with Barack Obama.
That's good.
He was at Harvard. Barack and I used to, as we say, throw down. We used to play basketball together. He's pretty good, but he wasn't as good as I was, I think. Other than that, he beats me on every front.
I've drunk a certain amount of scotch with both Robert Kennedy and Daniel Patrick Moynihan.
Wow, that is fantastic. That.
So I was very privileged. I was very lucky.
Yeah, that's priceless. There, that is just priceless. I really envy you. And you said you also in the pre-interview had met or talked to Lyndon Baines Johnson.
Yes, I did, because I was a White House correspondent, and I was working for a Sunday paper in England, The Observer, and therefore Saturday was my big day for hard news, and I used to go to the White House on a Saturday for the press briefing. There'd only be about a dozen people there on those days. And quite often, LBJ would just wander in and and take the briefing himself in place of either Salinger or George Reedy. I did get to know him a little bit.
Yeah, that's amazing. He's one of my favorite. I mean, I think he's, I don't know if I should really say this, because as a professional historian, you're not supposed to say these things, but I think he's a particularly American figure and tragic American figure.
Well, I, what I really would most like to do now is to do a one-volume life of LBJ, because there isn't really.
No, there isn't. There is that very, I'm sorry, I'm going to be embarrassed here. There is an extraordinarily long biography of LBJ by an author whose name I cannot forget. It's very well.
Robert Caro.
Exactly right. Yes, and it's, yeah, it's two volumes, I think. And
I think he's more. I think he's actually into the fourth volume.
Oh, geez, I can't.
And he's kind of losing momentum too. I think.
I don't know. That's a lot of.
That's a lot of pages. I mean, my attention. I have young children at home, so my attention span is about 3 minutes. So anyway, yeah. Well, that's an amazing experience, and of course, it informs everything in this book. Let me turn to the book itself then, and ask you how you came to write it.
Well, I came to write it really because of a combination of, well, sort of three things, really. One was a sort of serious but not particularly sophisticated historian's perceptive that the history of the United States was being written as though it was kind of different from the history of other countries. And I noticed a series of, as a matter of fact, rather good lives of the founding fathers that were coming up, but they were not really what I was brought up, not least in the United States, to think of as history. In other words, they were hagiographical, really. That was one thing. The second thing is I began to find I was very, very out of sympathy with the Bush administration, and particularly angered, really, that any criticism of the Bush administration was immediately put down to something called anti-Americanism, which I resented since I'd spent my entire life devoted to the United States. And the third thing was a certain number of irritations. I mean, I remember giving a talk at London University, and an elderly retired American historian came up and explained to me patiently, as speaking to a child, that everybody else had something called nationalism, and the United States was the only country that had something called patriotism. And sometime around the same time, I was on a radio talk, and somebody from, you'd be amazed to hear, the American Enterprise Institute came on the program, and it was quite apparent that this woman was under the impression that the United States alone defeated Nazi Germany, and that neither the wicked British Empire nor the even more wicked Soviet Union had anything to do with it. And this kind of accumulation of these little bits of grit in the oyster made me think that there was a book to write. Now, the other thing, of course, is that I've been writing a book about Thanksgiving. And I came to realize that there'd been a huge amount of myth-making about the Founding Fathers and about the Plymouth, and in particular, I was amused by a number of sort of grossly ahistorical, you know, the famous thing the famous thing about the city built upon a hill, and Winthrop, Reagan, on every possible opportunity, described in graphic terms how Winthrop had made this sermon in a boat off the coast of Massachusetts, when actually it was made in a church in Southampton. And the mythic quality of a lot of the most cherished anecdotes of American exceptionalism. And I suppose I began the book in a mixture of irritation, ideological irritation, and really sort of a disappointed love, really, which I tried to explain in the preface of the book, and possibly not with great success.
No, you did. You did explain it with great success. I, of course, you know, sometimes in these interviews, I will confess to the listeners that I have to ask questions to which I already know the answer because I've read the book. So, yes, it is very well explained in the introduction, kind of beautifully explained too, because it's clear that while you haven't fallen out of love with America, you are disappointed with recent events. And I can say that
I would dispute that I've fallen out of love with America. I've fallen out of love with a certain way of writing about America.
Right. Okay. Yeah, no, I'm sorry. Maybe I misspoke. But I can say that I have also, as an American, encountered some elements of American exceptionalism, and I've also found what is really a quite shocking ignorance of certain things, and World War II is one of them, and I actually teach military history here, and one of the things that I'm always at pains to point out is while the United States played a significant role in World War II, it was largely won by the Soviets, which is something you point out as well, and that's quite true. Let me kind of launch us into a discussion of American exceptionalism by proposing to you a distinction, and I don't know if you have made this distinction before in talking about the book, but I want to distinguish on the one hand the ideology of American exceptionalism, which is sometimes called American messianism, and then on the other hand, and we'll talk about this in the second part, that is the empirical question of American uniqueness, that is how different was America's history and nature from that of other comparable nations.
Yes.
And these are very different questions, I think. So let's begin with what I'll just call American messianism, or the ideology of American exceptionalism. What are its origins?
Well, I think one of its origins is in European Protestantism. And this is one of the main points I'm trying to make, is that a great deal of what is both good and less attractive about the United States is firmly rooted in European culture, not just high culture, but in, and one of the aspects of Protestantism is this sense of being a chosen people with a mission to bring to the world with a destiny to reach the world, and I think that I'm trying to avoid calling them the Pilgrims because they didn't call themselves Pilgrims, but let's go ahead and call them the Pilgrim Fathers. I think they had a vision of themselves as destined essentially to worship God in their own way. That's what they meant, understood by freedom. And I think that idea was one which was rooted in German and Netherlands and English and Scots Protestantism, and it's certainly to be found all over Europe in the 16th and 17th centuries. I think the next thing that kicks in, so to speak, is that the United States, or actually America, colonial America too, offered practical freedoms of a kind that were not available in Europe. And one of those was the availability of free land. And in fact, quite a few early American thinkers identified free land as the single most important difference between life in Europe and life in the United States. Now, if you want to be kind of bitchy, you can say, well, the land is free because they chased the Native Americans off it. But the fact is that in most of Europe, by the 17th century, it was very, very hard to acquire land. And in colonial America, it was very easy to acquire land. In fact, virtually everybody, except women, slaves, blacks, and newly arrived immigrants, could aspire to earning that.
So, if you trace its origins to this kind of Protestant notion of freedom, which I quite like, I like the conception that is freedom to worship, and then associated with freedom to acquire territory or landed property. But at some point, though, in the American Revolution or the Revolutionary Era, the notion sort of gels and becomes politicized, doesn't it? And
yes.
It's in the Founding Fathers occasionally, as we call
it. Yes, I think one thing to add at this point, which I do believe, but I'm not sure that I've succeeded in proving, as it were, in the book, is that I think that America was, the United States was more exceptional in the first 60 years, that's to say, between the Revolution and the Civil War, than later.
Mm-hmm.
That a number of things, of which urbanization and industrialization are the two most obvious, made the United States in many ways more like Europe mm-hmm. after 1865 than mm-hmm. it had been before.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other thing which is, I think, quite important is that there is a tendency in the United States in what you might call sort of formal patriotism to be found in high school texts and in you know, July the 4th oratory, which is to compare the United States with the Europe as it was before 1800.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, to fail to notice that many of the freedoms which were not available in Europe in the 18th century were well before the end of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think one has to put this rather carefully, but what I'm trying to say is that the official American patriotism ignores the changes that were happening in many other parts of the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah, I've encountered that as well. So then, after it enters the Founding Fathers, then it is further elaborated. Is this correct? It was further elaborated in the 19th century, particularly by people like Jackson? And you associate it with this notion of manifest destiny.
Well, I think in a way that the two key figures are Jefferson and Madison.
Mm-hmm.
Because they really do work out a coherent political theory and philosophy which is about freedom. Now, I think you have to be very, very careful. When George W. Bush speaks about freedom, I'm not quite sure what he means. I think he means freedom from being ruled by George III. you see what I mean? But that's mm-hmm. not really kind of an option at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I do think that Madison in particular made a philosophically serious attempt to create a political system which was based not just on the rule of law, but on popular sovereignty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was original. It was not wholly original,
mm-hmm.
because certainly the people who are sometimes called the old Whigs or the Parliament man, the people described in Caroline Robbins' book in the early 18th century in England were working on the same lines. But of course, the trouble was that they were not free to say so.
Mm-hmm.
Jefferson and Madison were in a position where they had made themselves mm-hmm. free to say so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So there is a sense in which the American Revolution does create real, though limited, political freedom.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I see. So then again, let's move forward a little bit in the 19th century and past Madison and Jefferson and
I'm certainly not hugely enthusiastic about Jackson.
Yes, no, you're
not. Seem to me
well,
that
it's honestly hard to be enthusiastic about Jackson in hindsight. But,
yeah, I think so.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, he did some things. I think that's the most we can say. Let's talk a little bit about Tocqueville, because a lot of people, and I think yourself included, mentioned that Tocqueville, or the way Americans read Tocqueville, has a lot to do with the further evolution of this notion of American exceptionalism or American messianism. Maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yes. Well, I see Tocqueville in a slightly different way. I mean, Tocqueville was a Democrat. He was also a very conservative Democrat. He didn't have much difficulty with the idea of optimates, the idea of rule by the best,
mm-hmm.
which is, after all, what aristocracy means, literally. I think that Tocqueville may well have been right in perceiving equality as the characteristic of American society as he met it west of the Alleghenies, at least, in the 1830s. But that is by no means the most striking characteristic of American society today.
Mm-hmm.
In many ways, it's one of the least equal societies in the world,
mm-hmm.
both financially and in some other ways, culturally, educationally, and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
So one of the stories is that is a story of decline in certain respects, that the United States was not, as is sometimes suggested, the first place in the world where there was free or virtually free education for all.
Mm-hmm.
But it was nevertheless a country in which the access to education, practical freedom, religious freedom, possibility of acquiring land, all of these things were, on the whole, more available earlier than they were elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
However, what I am arguing against is this: the notion of exceptionalism in the sense of the United States being sort of totally different and as a place where all these political good things
mm-hmm.
only were to be found.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I see exactly. So then let's take the story forward into the 20th century, and a couple of people that you mentioned as primary expositors of the myth, as you call it, of American exceptionalism were Woodrow Wilson on the one hand, and then most recently George Bush. Maybe you could talk a little bit about the way in which it was the notion evolved in the 20th century.
Well, I mean, Wilson was a Southerner. He was quite clearly racist.
Mm-hmm.
It's almost sort of like shooting fish in a barrel to pick contrast between what Wilson said he believed and the way he acted.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't mean to say that his politics were wholly invalid, or even that they were particularly bad. But it's very hard for me to see Woodrow Wilson except through the lens of Keynes's famous description of this sort of hypocritical preacher, as it were. That is reinforced by the fact that I spent 3 years writing a biography of Colonel House,
mm-hmm.
and the way in which Wilson has been protected and defended by a historical school in pretty an unscrupulous way in the context of House brought me to understand how well, I mean, I just basically think Wilson was not a very nice man.
Mm-hmm.
He was a wonderful orator, even if he did tend to speak in iambic hexameters. What I do think is the case is that well, let's back up. Both the Clinton administration and the second Bush administration described themselves on every possible occasion as being neo-Wilsonian,
mm-hmm.
and the only thing that can really mean, I think, is that they accepted and wished to carry forward Wilson's rather naive plans for making the world democratic, whatever exactly that means.
Mm-hmm.
Now, one of the things that happened, I think, between 1919 and 2000 is that alongside the classic principles of freedom and democracy, a particular kind of economic freedom or a particular style of capitalism had become strapped onto this messianic message that was being brought to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what
although there's a great argument about what exactly it means, that, you know, I'm talking about the Washington Consensus,
mm-hmm.
and the idea that the United States should use its weight in international affairs to propagate the financial deregulation, privatization of public functions, all those things which are generally labeled as the Washington Consensus. It was actually new, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I think to give George W. Bush a break, I think he was by no means the only American statesman in the 1990s and the beginning of this century who kind of believed that that was the national mission.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah. Let's turn directly to. I mean, I think that most readers will be very interested in your understanding of the way in which the ideology of American exceptionalism impacted or affected the Bush administration's to go to war after 9/11 in Afghanistan, in Iraq. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that. Is there a direct link between Bush and his belief, or the belief of his advisors, that America had some sort of messianic mission and this turn to force in the Near East?
I think one of the things is I've just this morning was listening to Tony Blair repeating what he'd said in his famous Chicago speech, but basically this justifying liberal interventionism.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that a lot of people in the United States took for granted, even before 9/11, that liberal interventionism was justified.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a fairly new idea. I mean, you can say, okay, Jefferson took on the Tripoli pirates. That you can call that liberal interventionism if you want. You can certainly say that you can't very easily say that Wilson's decision to go to war in 1917 was liberal interventionism, because he resisted that decision to the bitter end.
Mm-hmm.
Nor can you really say that Franklin Roosevelt took the United States into war against Hitler, because, technically speaking, it was Germany that declared war on the United
mm-hmm.
States. But
mm-hmm.
that's rather, trifling, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly, the idea that it was the duty of the United States to use force to spread its beliefs in the world reached, a new intensity or a new confidence
mm-hmm.
in the last 20 years. Or 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I would say that I'm not an American historian, but I can say that I quite agree with you that my impression was that that American political leaders since the mid-19th century have been very hesitant to involve themselves in what is sometimes called foreign entanglements, and that at each moment they resisted quite strongly, and in some cases we even condemn them for resisting. And we today, mm-hmm. looking back on it, say they should have gotten in sooner than they did. But doesn't that kind of vitiate the notion that that the ideology of American exceptionalism was moving American policy?
Well, I would look at this from a different point of view. If you look at the project for a new American century,
mm-hmm.
which clearly did have some influence on the second Bush administration, although actually not right at the beginning. I think it was only after 9/11 that this particular coterie of people became influential.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as I can see, the basic idea is the United States must be militarily powerful and uniquely powerful. It's almost a kind of looking for enemies to justify military power.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, all great nations spend resources on defending themselves, and,
mm-hmm.
and they have continuing discussions about what level of military expenditure is necessary. But it seems to me that somehow the idea of the lone superpower,
mm-hmm.
which always makes me giggle, because it always makes me think of
of the Italian journalist Arianna Fallaci teasing Henry Kissinger about being the Lone Ranger. I mean, the word lone is not the usual word in the English language in this country. So, you know, one would say the only. Mm-hmm. You can say the United States is the only superpower. The moment you say the lone superpower, you hear the theme music of a cowboy TV series in the background. It does seem to me that there's an element of vain glory, but more than that, lurking behind that of self-interest. That there are groups in the United States who have a powerful interest in an excessive level of military expenditure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me just pose it's a friendly but challenging question. I agree with you that there is this set of interests, and that the Project for the New American Century and so on and so forth, maybe the American Enterprise Institute, some of these other what are really kind of right-leaning or right-wing think tanks do hold that America should play an important and maybe even dominant role in the world militarily. But my specific question, and this is, I put on my historian's hat here,
right,
is whether that ideology had any impact really on Wilson's decision to go, or something like that, Wilson's decision to enter the First World War, Roosevelt's decision to enter the Second World War, or he was obviously forced by the Japanese-Germans, but and then most importantly, and this is where I'd like you to concentrate, in the Bush administration's decision to go to war in Afghanistan and in Iraq. Because if you look at what they said, I think, I don't have perfect recall, they said they wanted to fight state-sponsored terrorism and spread democracy.
Yeah.
Those are very, you know, I think as you would say, those are very common goals among many, many advanced nations today. There's nothing odd about them.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I personally was not I had no problem at all with the United States pursuing Al-Qaeda into Afghanistan. It seemed to me, while that might be unwise, and indeed it turned out to be unwise, seemed to me kind of inevitable. You know, I wasn't at all surprised by that. The Iraq matter, again, I didn't start out with the feeling that that was necessarily wrong. I gradually, not in fact fairly rapidly, began to realize that we were being sold a whole series of bills of goods to justify something which they wanted to do anyway for reasons they were not telling us about.
Yeah, I do wonder about that too, though, and you do say this, and many people who I very much respect say that the Bush administration wanted to go to war with Iraq from the beginning, but is there any? I mean, what is the evidence of that, other than the fact that his father?
Well, there are a lot of them. There's a lot of evidence, if you count it as evidence, in the various memoirs. I mean, Richard Clark's book and Paul O'Neill's book, and others. I mean, there's a certain amount of stuff about, you know, he's the guy who tried to kill my dad and all of this stuff.
I shouldn't laugh at that.
Myself regard this as conclusive. What I do think is that there was an almost comical degree of hubris in people like Rumsfeld.
Yeah, no, I think that's right.
And even more Dick Cheney.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, I know that, you know, you don't have to be a careful reader of history to understand that intervention in a place like Afghanistan might not be a good idea.
Yeah,
yeah, really. Better people have tried, or better nations.
There are some interesting transformations. The last time I saw Pat Moynihan alive, before he died, I was expressing irritation with the, you know, people who I described as these people. And he said, well, who do you mean? You mean the president? And I said, well, I mean Rumsfeld and Cheney, you know. He said, oh, you mean my two liberal friends from the Nixon administration? And of course, it's true that they were relative Republican liberals.
Yeah.
And there's an evolution or a change. And I think one of the crucial things is not 9/11, but 11/9. That's to say, it's the fall of the Berlin Wall persuaded a great many people in the United States, you know, that now we're the lone superpower, we don't have to take any of this shit from anybody. And, in particular, the failure of the European countries to respond adequately to what was happening in the Balkans,
mm-hmm.
had a tremendous effect and encouraged people, encouraged a certain kind of impatience,
mm-hmm.
which developed into a certain kind of arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's quite an important sort of narrative there. But I'm very, very clear, I was very, very clear pretty rapidly that the Bush administration's response to 9/11 was unwise, that declaring a war on terror,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it seems to me, I'm not being pedantic or academic if I say it's a bad idea to declare war on an abstract noun. You
mm-hmm.
know?
Yeah, no. I
how do you ever get out of it? How do you win?
It's true. That is a tough one to win. But I would almost say, I like the point that you made about the Balkans conflict in particular, because it seems to me that one of the touchstones of American foreign policy for the past 100 years, and really one of its primary drivers, has been, in fact, let's put a strong term on it, disgust with Europe. Basically, that the Europeans could not keep their own house in order, and we had to go take care of them. And that I think really did drive American foreign policy on all of the three occasions that I just cited, that is with Wilson and Roosevelt and with Bush, that all of them felt that the Europeans weren't going to step up or that they were behaving badly, and somebody had to go take care of a bad situation. But I'm not sure that's the same as American messianism. But we can, that's a...
Well, I think, of course, that there's a very strong strain of anti-British feeling, which goes right back. And
mm-hmm.
If you take somebody like John Quincy Adams, he was forever seeing British interference. We've got to do this, that, or the other, or the British will, That's very strong, I think.
Yeah.
And it's understandable. And, of course, the other thing which is understandable, though not apparently understood very well in Britain, is that Americans are, by definition, people who left Europe because they or their ancestors have had a bad time in Europe.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's a very constant strand.
Uh-huh.
And that's by no means irrational.
Uh-huh. No, I see what you mean. It's funny because I was just reading the other day a book that, among other things, touched on the American response to the Suez Crisis. And you should hear what some of the American officials say about the British. Oh, they were
really, Schadenfreude, yeah. Absolutely.
The special relationship was very special at that time.
Well, I mean, my friend David Watts, who sadly died young, was a brilliant political commentator. I remember writing a piece saying, this special relationship sort of was invented by the British in 1916. And it was certainly over by 1956. I mean, talk about a short 20th century.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, that's funny.
I mean, throughout the 19th century, one of the main strands of American attitudes to the world was disdain for disdain mixed with envy and rivalry with Britain. And there's a very powerful Irish input into that, of course.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, it's an interesting question. Well, we're about halfway done, so I want to switch gears now and turn to this empirical question, this historical question about American uniqueness, and that is, just to remind our listeners, how America's history and nature actually, empirically, differs from that of other comparable states. And I've listed a series of statements that are sometimes said about that make America different from comparable states. And I just want to kind of go through them and talk about them. The first one is, America is truly democratic in a way that other nations haven't been or aren't. And one of the things you point out, quite rightly, is that American political institutions have European origins. But I wonder if it isn't the case that, in the American context, certain aspects of them were exaggerated in such a way that really actually did make them very different than any other nation.
I sort of don't feel very comfortable with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that one of the things which is, I think really very widely believed in the United States is that class, in the sense of class domination or class privilege, it doesn't exist in the United States.
And mm-hmm.
that has always made me laugh, because there are obvious class differences and class prejudices, and if you read one of my favorite books, which is The Education of Henry Adams, I mean, here you have
an upper-class man who's almost strangled by his contemporaries, inferiors, as he sees them, to the point where he can't bring himself really to decide what work to do because he feels everybody is such idiots.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he ends up feeling the only three people in the world, you know, Clarence King and John Hay, and he are the only people who can understand everything.
Mm-hmm.
Except a few scientists. You know,
I was thinking in the 19th century about Tocqueville again, and I don't think it's too much to say that he actually does say that America is democratic in a way that other nations are not.
Yes, he does, and I think he focuses on equality. I mean, not democracy.
Yeah, I think that's right. He seems to use the two as synonyms, really, but yeah.
You know, people tend to think because the book's called Democracy in America, it must be in favor of democracy,
yeah,
but actually, he's very unsure that democracy is a desirable political system or ideology.
Just to take the point a little bit further, then, that America was, again, truly democratic in a way other nations are. Haven't been art. But one of the things interesting about America that might make it unique historically is that our democracy has been, with some notable exceptions, very stable compared to others. It has been of a longer duration than comparable democracies. And that's interesting, kind of an interesting way to put the thing, because it has been so stable and of such long duration that the only democracy which it can really be compared to is that in the United Kingdom.
Well, I mean, it seems to me there's an element here of defining the question in such a way that you defining the competition in such a way that you always win it. If you start, as many Americans do, by saying that monarchy, even constitutional monarchy, excludes one from the ranks of democracy, well then obviously the United States is more democratic. But actually. It's not, to me, self-evident that the United States is the only country with democratic traditions. I mean, for one thing, the Scandinavian countries and Holland and Britain have had, the rule of law for a very long time, and it's respected. And on the whole, I would say that those six or seven countries right there. I mean, to the extent that they have, and I think it's true more broadly in Europe, actually, to the extent that people haven't always been democracies, because they haven't always been able to defend themselves from somebody else brutally destroying their democracy.
That's true. That's a good point.
The other thing that we really don't know much about is how other societies would have developed had it not been for colonialism. It tends to be assumed, even by people who are anti-colonial and anti-imperial, that somehow colonialism was imposed on a tabula rasa, and that there were no legal systems or political systems in any non-European societies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, here one's getting into that kind of meta-history of the sort of the kind of Toynbee or what's his face, a German inventor of this kind of thing, which I rather suspect anyway. But I'm not at all happy with the idea that the United States is sort of the only democratic country, because it's a circular argument. You say, oh, what do you mean by democracy? Well, what I mean is what we have in the United States.
Yeah, I think when people say these things, they mean that, again, if we're just speaking about comparable nations, and those would mostly be Europeans, if not entirely, is that, you know, for example, we had no turn to fascism. We had no turn to interventionist or kind of hypertrophic communism.
If I were really provocative, I would say that there was a kind of fascism in the American South for 100 years after the Civil War.
Mm-hmm. There's something to that, I suppose.
If you look at one-party states with a racial basis and a very powerful sort of military tradition... I can make a case that the state of Mississippi and the state of Alabama were quasi-fascist.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Okay.
Well, if you don't mind, let me go on to the next of these propositions that is sometimes forwarded, and that is that America is a nation of immigrants in a way that other nations haven't been or aren't. This is an extraordinarily common one, and just on first glance.
Well, that's simply not true. I had a very extraordinary conversation in a conference in Oxford, and a woman, a female academic from whose name I've forgotten, luckily, was holding forth about how she was said to be an expert on France, and she said it was quite impossible for anybody in France for an immigrant to achieve anything. And I said, well, you know, I don't know whether Sarkozy is an immigrant or not, because it depends on exactly what age he was when he was brought to the country. But let me say something else. I said, my first wife's family were French and Jews. Among them, two of them have been prime ministers, two of them have been governors of the bank. One of them has been a governor of the Bank of France. Well, at least one of them have been members of the French Academy.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other non-Jewish side of my French family, one of them was an Italian, very limited education, who walked in across the border and qualified as a lawyer and ended up as foreign minister.
Mm-hmm.
It's just simply not true that there are no opportunities for immigrants in other countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that the proposition is just slightly different, and that is that I think the way that people would put it, isn't it different to say that on the one hand, one can immigrate to, say, France, and on the other hand, America is entirely comprised, excepting Native Americans, of immigrants? Is there not a kind of – that's a quantitative difference, but isn't it also a qualitative difference?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I suppose, again, first of all, there are a lot of other countries that which were built by immigrants, of Brazil, Argentina, Canada, Australia. France has had the same proportion of foreign-born since about 1890 as the United States.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's interesting.
One of the most fascinating little factoids that I know about the United States is I discovered in a footnote to a general history, which is Morrison and Commager, which is that one third of all the people who migrated to the United States in the 19th century went home.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, they did. That's right.
33 million people went to the United States, and 11 million went home.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, it's almost the same, almost exactly the same number, slightly less, if you take the period 1865 to 2000.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the extent of immigration, while wonderfully liberating and creative for some, was obviously not as much of a success for others.
Mm-hmm. So, you wouldn't favor the argument that says that America discovered a way to integrate many different kinds of people in a way that other nations had not, and therefore showed something to the world about the way in which people of all different ethnicities can get along.
A nation of nations.
A nation of nations, yeah.
I think it's exaggerated, but on this point, as on many others, the thing that troubles me is the idea that these discussions are not really held in order to arrive at the truth. They're self-pleasing arguments, basically intended to say, as the Pharisees said, thank God I'm not as other men are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree with you completely that arguments that are comforting are often too comforting.
Yeah, the last sentence of my preface, which I wanted to be the title of the book, is the dangers of self-praise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I can see that. So let me...
Let me be quite frank about it. If you're British, or for that matter, if you're French, you're pretty well aware of the dangers of self-praise.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we've been praising ourselves in a pompous, boring way for several hundred years, and the French do the same. So, by the way, do the Germans and the Spanish and the Russians and, you know, and the Chinese, good God.
Yeah, no, it's quite funny. So let me go on to the – I have a couple more of these, and we're almost out of time here, but I want to run through them really quickly. The next proposition is that America is imperial or not imperial, that is not imperial, in a way that other nations have been imperial. That is, we have avoided the kind of standard sort of great power imperialism.
Well, again, it seems to me that's rather the same thing, which is defining the terms of the argument in such a way that
mm-hmm.
it's in it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the United States, after all, you know, conquered a continent,
mm-hmm.
And it's simply not the case that it was. People thought that it was empty. It was not only that there were Native Americans there, but also, you know, large chunks of it belonged to other countries.
Yes, yes, that's true.
Notably to Mexico,
uh-huh.
you know.
Uh-huh.
And when the opportunity arose, in other words, when the United States had finished expanding over the North American continent, it proceeded to start moving in on Pacific Islands and on the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
And after all, there was a very, very strong movement in the South throughout the 19th century to bring, you know, Cuba and other Caribbean islands and Nicaragua and other places in different ways and different times in something which is known as the Empire of Liberty.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but then, how would you respond to someone who said, but then it seems to be, in the time of Wilson or maybe a little bit before even, America turns its back on imperialism and we begin to withdraw from all our very few foreign possessions. That is the Philippines and Cuba and these other areas. Granted, we kept Hawaii, which I guess is good for us.
Well, yeah, but I mean, as I was saying, that the territory of the continent of North America was not empty.
Yeah, no, that's right. I think that
Americans shared with Europeans, including Russians, as well as the British and the French and the Germans and the Spanish and the Portuguese, a restless desire for trade and territory and wealth and expansion.
Hmm.
If you want to say that until 1898 the United States was said to be expanding on land that it didn't expand overseas, I'd have to agree with you.
Yeah.
But that's not a moral proposition.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I see what you mean. No, that's a – yeah, no, I think there was something of a sea change around 1914, but we can argue about that on the next show. So let me go.
Well, in fact, there's some very interesting people like Carl Schurz and so on who were saying some things against empire
mm-hmm.
Before 1900, which sounds very contemporary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So let's move on to the next of these propositions, and that is it's the much beloved America is the land of opportunity in a way that other nations haven't been or aren't. Tocqueville, I think, says this, and it's repeated constantly. The land of opportunity is something every American can say, and usually every immigrant to American can say, whether they're poor or not.
Only in America. Right.
Only in America, yeah.
Yeah. Well, obviously the United States has been a land of opportunity for some people. It's not been equally a land of opportunity for everybody. And equally, other people in other countries have managed to seize opportunities as well. An interesting way of looking at this, which is sort of the way I was brought up in a sort of naive middle-class English family, was that the people who went off and emigrated abroad were the people who couldn't make it to home.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But would you say that again, we could probably cite statistics about mobility and this kind of thing, or we could go to anecdotal evidence, like I suppose Barack Obama is a bit of an example. But
he's not an immigrant, whatever else.
No, he's not an immigrant. No, in fact, he was raised His mother and stepmother were from Kansas. Grandmother, as am I.
And his father was a visiting student.
Yeah, no, that's right. So I hope Barack and I are. I think of him as a Kansan like me. So, and I know Kansans are great and ambitious. I do wonder if there isn't something to the point that people seem to come to America in order to seek opportunity because they haven't found it where they are. Whenever I talk to immigrants, that's what they say. They say, I think I can do things here that I can't do at home. Yeah.
Of course that's true. But it's not necessarily the whole truth.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I know a man in Washington who comes from Honduras who's built up a very successful business as an importer of seafood, and he runs a very good store, and he's made a lot of money, and that's terrific, and he's very proud of himself, and he's devoted American patriot because he believes he couldn't have done this in Honduras, and for all I know, that may be so. On the other hand, I know people who've emigrated to Brazil and to Australia and to France, and they've done very well there too.
Mm-hmm.
If the proposition is simply that it's been marginally easier to be successful in certain ways in the United States than elsewhere, then historically that's probably true.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the exclusive mm-hmm. claim that seems to me an odd
mm-hmm.
one.
No, I see just what you mean. I do wonder who makes that claim, but I'm sure there are such people. So let me.
Oh well. Listen, I mean, one of the most interesting things, it's only 2 pages long, is the introduction to a history of the United States written by a man who, in my opinion, is a genuinely great historian, Daniel Burstein.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a string of ludicrously exaggerated exceptionalist propositions. Well, what makes us Americans different? Well, we believe in being fair, you know. Ridiculous statements as if nobody else believes in being fair.
That is a bit much.
And I think it's possibly rather hard for somebody who is American to realize how annoying his propositions are, just at a simple level.
I can see just what you mean, and I really I want to say before, if I haven't said this already, that I'm of the opinion that the opinions of non-Americans like yourself are extraordinarily important for us and should always be heard, because you see things that we absolutely do not, and I'm a firm believer in that. I mean, I personally am an expert.
I've always been very reluctant to appear to be critical of the United States, and in everything that I've written, I've gone out of my way to source every opinion on an American original.
Yeah.
And then finally, in this last book, one of my children said to me that it's the first time you've really written in a personal book.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I guess one of the reasons was I sort of felt, well, do I really... am I really not allowed to have an opinion of my own on this subject? there's another thing that strikes me. I remember I tried to explain this in a talk in California a couple of months ago. Population of the United States is between 4% and 5% of the population of the world.
Mm-hmm.
If the United States wants to export democracy to the world, does that include the idea of giving to the other 96% of the world's population any voice in what happens in the world?
Mm-hmm.
At the moment, there's no suggestion of allowing the Chinese to get a bigger vote in the IMF than 4%, though they're about, 23% of the world's population.
Mm-hmm.
Again, if you define things in ways which always end up with you winning the argument,
mm-hmm.
It raises some doubts about how genuine this democratic spirit really is.
Yeah, I certainly see what you mean, and actually this comes to the it's a nice segue to the fifth of the propositions on American uniqueness I wanted you to respond to, and that is that America has defended liberty and democracy abroad in ways and times and places in which other nations have not or were not willing to.
Well, of course, the British response to that is to say that we entered two wars against fascism 2 years before you did, in both cases, and got thoroughly thrashed for our pains.
Yeah. That's quite true. But more generally, if we say America and the UK have selflessly stood up for liberty and democracy in ways that other nations have not, how would you respond?
Well, to some extent that is factually the case, although I would say that a number of other countries, including both France and Australia and Canada, you know, have also shown themselves willing to bear their share. If one then goes on from that to saying that only the United States is willing to accept responsibility for other people, then one would say, well, then why did you decide to sabotage the League of Nations?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, there is something to that, but I think that.
But again, I feel uncomfortable with this because I feel I'm being sort of jockeyed into the position into an anti-American position, which is not really mine. I do admire the extent to which willing to undertake responsibilities, as have other countries, including mine. I feel profoundly uncomfortable with the discourse in which the nature of which is, how can you not agree with me that I'm better than you are?
Yeah. No, I think anybody, any rational person, rational sort of self-aware person would be uncomfortable with that. And I certainly am as well. I do think, though, that, you know, I'm sure that your book will be extraordinarily widely reviewed, but I can already predict that the reviews will say, thank you very much, Godfrey Hodgson, for showing us to ourselves. Because I really think there's a lot of that in America as well.
Well, so far I've had two notable reviews, one of which was an absolutely poisonous review. No sort of problem guessing where that was. It was in Commentary magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was a very thoughtful and sympathetic, but on the whole critical review in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
I had the other interesting thing. So I had a very nasty review in the Financial Times by who? An Englishman who's emigrated to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I would expect that, you know, as you see it on blogs and see it in reviews, that you will. I hope.
Okay.
I don't know. Maybe
no,
I'm wrong. Maybe I've got my countrymen all wrong.
Let me say, one of the things I've always been deeply impressed by is the willingness of Americans to be critical of their own society. Indeed, mm-hmm. I mean, many of the critical ideas that I have, I learned from Americans.
Yeah.
Well, this is one of the actual points I wanted to make, and it'll be the final question that I have for you, and that is that, you know, you say in the book that this notion of the I would call it again the ideology of American exceptionalism or American Mexicanism is widely held by Americans. But just recently, we voted a regime out of power, which seems to have been inspired, at least according to your version of events, by the ideology of American exceptionalism. So, how can both these things be the case? I mean, have we come to our senses suddenly?
Well, I mean, yes, yes. But also, let us say that it did take 8 years,
mm-hmm.
and that, you know, it was by no means certain that Senator Obama would win the election until the particular version of capitalism which is being wished on the world by Professor Summers and Mr. Greenspan and Secretary Rubin,
mm-hmm.
Had sort of collapsed in a pile of dust.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was really only after, as we say, Lehman Brothers, that it was certain that the United States was prepared to accept a fellow with these
mm-hmm.
Antinomian ideas.
Antinomian, that's a good way of putting it.
And good luck to him.
Yeah, I say good luck to him, too.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want that job.
That's
a tough one.
Yeah, I saw somebody just in some completely different context the other day was saying, my God, you've aged. You look as though you were the president of the United States.
Exactly. Well, I was going to say, if Barack is listening, I would be happy to play basketball with him again, but if he needs help fixing the country, I got nothing. I got absolutely nothing.
Well, I must say, I am a huge admirer of his. I thought particularly his first book was absolutely brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
I think he's extremely skilled politically, but
yeah,
I think he's got a hell of a problem on his
mm-hmm.
hands.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I think
rather, you know, I've always thought in the end, you know, what gets you is
you know, in the end, is that one of the illnesses that you have prevents the doctors fixing the other one.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm afraid that's his problem, too, that he can't fix the things that he set out to fix very easily,
mm-hmm.
Because of the financial problems, which are...
Yeah.
And I think one of the oddest things is how many of the people responsible for those problems he's brought into the administration.
That is truly incredible. Timothy Geithner. I mean, he was. I don't mean to launch off into a political discussion, but
no.
I mean, if anybody is responsible for this, it's got to be Timothy Geithner. He
was
he was asleep at the switch. I mean, he was the guy there.
I mean, I have had only one very brief and very pleasant experience with Mr. Rubin, who couldn't be more helpful to me in a small matter, but he is the man who lobbied and pushed for deregulation and for the repeal of Glass-Steagall for years.
Yeah, no.
If any single man has responsibility for what's happened, he...
I don't know. I don't understand it. Well, anyway, we've taken up a huge amount of your time, and I really appreciate it. It's been a great conversation. Let me close with our traditional final question, that is, what are you working on now? What is your next book about?
Well, I've got a book, a biography of Martin Luther King, which is about to be published very soon, in a matter of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
And I am trying to persuade a number of publishers, most of whom are not rushing forth with buckets of money at the moment, to let me write a one-volume life of Lyndon Johnson.
Well, let me tell them, if they're listening, that they should let you do that and give you a six-figure contract tomorrow.
Oh,
because I would love to interview about that, because, as I say, Johnson is just a character that I find endlessly fascinating.
Yeah.
I mean,
one
of the stories about him is so typically American. I don't know if it's true, you tell me. That is that Johnson, after elections, he wondered why everyone didn't vote for him. He didn't quite understand. I just find that amazingly American.
Rationality would have dictated those two.
Right. Doesn't everybody like me? No, it's an amazing thing. Well, anyway.
I'm very grateful to you for being so merciful. I mean, you could have been much, much harder to me if you wanted to.
Oh, it's interesting. And I think one of the important things is that, I agree with some of the things in the book, and I don't agree with others. And what else would you expect? You know, I mean, that's the way friendly discourse is conducted. You know, John Stuart Mill said, you know, you got to get all the ideas out there and pick the right ones and then go forward.
Okay.
Yeah, so anyway, Godfrey Hodgson, we've taken up a ton of your time, and we really appreciate you being on the show. The book is The Myth of American Exceptionalism. It's just been published by Yale University Press. And promise me that when your next book comes out, you'll be on the show again. Okay?
I'd love to do that.
All
absolutely.
Right. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Enjoyed
all right.
It.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks. Bye.
You've been listening to an interview with Godfrey Hodgson about his new book, The Myth of American Exceptionalism. I'm Marshall Poe, the host of New Books in History. I hope you have a great week.